Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with fiction writer Lauren Groff, whose most recent books are Fates and Furies and the story collection Florida. She will be the 35th Zale Kimmerling Writer-in-Residence at Newcomb College Institute in March. We'll also hear from Amy Bonifons, whose new novel is The Regrets. It's a great pleasure to welcome Lauren Groff to The Reading Life. Lauren is the 2020 Zale Kimmerling Writer-in-Residence at Newcomb College Institute this March. The residency has been in existence since 1985, funded by Newcomb alums Dana Zale Girard and Martha McCarty Zimmerling. It has featured such writers as Dorothy Allison, Octavia Butler, Louise Gluck, Valerie Martin, Gloria Naylor, and Anne Patchett, to name only a few. Lauren Groff, the 35th in this number, is the author of the novels The Monsters of Templeton, shortlisted for the Orange Prize for New Writers, Arcadia, and Fates and Furies, a finalist for the National Book Award and the Kirkus Award. Her most recent collection of stories, Florida, was also nominated for the 2018 National Book Award. In 2017, she was named by Grantham Magazine as one of the best of young American novelists of her generation. She lives in Gainesville, Florida, with her husband, two sons, and a dog. Lauren Groff, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you inviting me on the show.
Now, you're such a great addition to this already impressive list, so I hope you're looking forward to being in New Orleans.
I am so excited to come to New Orleans and actually have time to enjoy the city. I've only ever been there as a tourist and briefly, so I don't remember much, but I'm excited to come again in a more serious guise.
Well, everybody's been reading your books to prepare, so you'll have a great audience.
Oh, excellent.
Now, so many of your books explore the idea of home. The Monsters of Templeton, for starters, was a love letter to your hometown of Cooperstown, New York.
Correct, yes. And I haven't been back for about 10 years, so, you know, the town is sort of frozen in my fictional imaginings of it for me. So, yes, it was.
So do you want to go back?
At this point, I don't know. I have gotten to the age where I think that I feel more nostalgia than eagerness to go back. It's very complex.
And then Arcadia explored the idea of an intentional community through the eyes of its youngest member, little bit of a hippie.
He's a little bit of a hippie. Yes, it does. That book came out of my bringing children into the world and being anxious about being unable to provide a utopian experience for them because the world is very strange and full of darkness and light.
So, yes, indeed. Yeah. And then we come to Florida, where you never expected to make your home.
True. And most days I wake up thinking, where am I again? Florida is still, after 15 years, an alien experience for me.
So what is it that makes it so alien to you?
I think that I am just not meant to live in the heat.
Well, that'll do it.
I think there are people who can handle it and people who can't, and I am unfortunately of the latter sort. But it's also, you know, it's just, Gainesville is a very interesting place. My life is very internal. I don't teach here, and so I spend most of my day working on my own writing, and that's a very solitary job. So I think part of it, too, is the fact that I'm in isolation most of the day.
I'm curious to know, I mean, because Florida seems to be such a muse for you. And, you know, lots of times people move to new places and they either write to explore the place or they wait until they feel they have the authority to write about the place. What was that process like for you?
I actually actually never intended to write about Florida. And in fact, it takes me two to five years to write about any place I've ever lived, just because it takes a while for the spirit of the place to enter you and then to become a story. I think the metabolism of the writer is relatively slow, or at least I am relatively slow. So I never thought I was going to write about Florida. And a few years passed, we didn't move. And I finally decided that I was going to start to love this place where I found myself. So I began reading all sorts of books about Florida, you know, Marjorie Kinnan Rollins, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, all sorts of beautiful books by, you know, Peter Matheson. And it was actually through literature that made me love the place I found myself in. And then literature breeds literature. So I started writing, despite my will, about Florida, first short stories, and then it appeared in my novels, too.
Well, it's such a lucky thing to be able to learn a place in that way. I mean, the first year we lived in New Orleans, which I wanted to come here and I loved it from the start, but I spent that first year and all I did was read about the place. And that's a real gift in getting to know your surroundings.
It's magnificent. Yes. Yeah. I think that it depends on who you are as a person. I think it sounds like, you know, you have this amazing show, and so you probably see the world somewhat through literature. And I'm like that, too. I have a very hard time understanding what I'm seeing until I've sort of read about it or thought through it in words, in text, and in other people's vision.
Now, I think we feel a real kinship with Florida and Louisiana because, for starters, we share the hurricane zone, and
Absolutely. Storms
aplenty appear in your work. What was your first hurricane, and what was it like for you to write about that?
Well, so I was afraid of hurricanes for the first 5 years of living here, which I should be. One should be very frightened. But the truth is, Gainesville is at the center of the state. We're 90 miles from either coast. And we have so many trees around that sort of stops a lot of the forward momentum of any storm. So our storms are relatively mild. We don't get a lot of flooding because we are surrounded by swamps. We only get trees blowing down, which is dangerous, but it's not as dangerous as storm surges or things that New Orleans knows very, very intimately. So it's frightening because my house has a tin roof and it sounds like a herd of elephants dancing. But beyond that, you know, there's a little festive air when people go to the grocery store, Publix, and buy out all the wine before any other food is bought out. For us, it's we worry about everyone else, the people on the coast, and the people in the south who will be smashed during hurricanes for sure.
Now, another thing I think they have in common, and you really show this, I think, in your stories, is that they're considered part of the nation's playground to start with. They're supposed to be carefree places. But they're also places where if you don't take care, if you look away for a second, all can be lost.
Yes, absolutely. And honestly, they're also carefree places if you're coming from privilege, right? And
right.
If you're blinding yourself to the way that people really struggle, in both places, I think. And it's easy to come to Florida or to New Orleans and, you know, go to Disney World or, you know, go down Bourbon Street and think that that is representative of the larger whole. But people are struggling in both places. And I think it is contingent on someone who is seeking to actually know the place to go and look more deeply than just the surface elements, just the playground elements.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with fiction writer Lauren Groff, whose most recent book is Florida. We'll be right back. Talk about writing about climate change, because that is woven into your work so beautifully and evenly. It's not a slap you in the face. It's just suddenly it's there, subtly and beautifully. And it's in Fates and Furies throughout, and it's in the Florida collection as well. So talk about your feelings about writing about climate change.
Oh, it's something I've struggled with for years now. In fact, it's in Arcadia too, and that was actually bringing that book into the world, because I was also bringing children into the world, and there's a profound moral burden on asking these questions of ourselves. Why are we doing this when it's our children who are going to suffer the most from climate change? So it's a very, very difficult thing to write about because you don't want to be polemical, right? Polemical fiction is generally fairly bad. And you also don't necessarily want to write dystopian work. I have very strong feelings about dystopian fiction. Some of it is incredibly good. But a lot of it acts as, I think, a false catharsis for the reader. It makes the reader feel as though they've done something when they've just read a book in which, you know, the human narrative wins out against the climate, which is not what we're up against.
Right.
So it feels unrealistic to me in a lot of ways. So I was trying to figure out a way to actually talk about climate change and write stories that sort of act as stories and maybe slide the climate change commentary in from the side, make it slant-wise as opposed to straight on. And I just found that maybe talking about my character's climate grief and climate dread was the way that I was going to go about doing it. In this day and age, if we're not addressing it, it feels like an intentional oversight. I mean, we say things with our silence also. And if we're being silent on this most radical change in human civilization, we're tacitly condoning what's happening to our planet. And I am passionate about not doing so, not tacitly condoning the way that the corporations are ruining our native land, our beauty, our incredible environmental richness, especially down here in Florida. So it's a moral question, right? I believe that artists choosing to disengage is a moral decision. And I am increasingly wounded whenever I read stories from people that I adore and whose voices I think are essential, and nothing occurs in their fiction or their poetry or their nonfiction, even remotely gesturing at this great chasm before us. It feels unrealistic to me. It feels like it's just intentional silence as opposed to unintentional silence. So this is something that I worked with Greenpeace in January. We had this incredible project where we asked a lot of the artists and thinkers and photographers and as many people as we could actually to talk about climate change and get them to actually address it on the spot. What we're trying to do is trying to get as many people as possible to just focus on climate change, because I think the first thing is just acknowledging it as a reality, taking a step toward the problem in whatever way we can make people take a step toward it. And for me, the first step is always art. And then after I make something, I can find other ways to attack a problem. But I always have to sort of mitigate or modulate my reaction through words, through my art.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with fiction writer Lauren Groff, whose most recent book is Florida. What sort of advice are you going to give to the students at Newcomb when you're here?
I don't know. I feel as though it's probably an individual case-by-case basis, right? I wouldn't want to give global advice because global advice tends to be wrong, I think, for most people. But I would say that if there's anything that I think that any artist or thinker should be welcoming into their lives, it's the idea of failure being not a negative thing. Failure is the way that we discover what it is we know about the world. It's the boundaries we come up against that inspire us to either go beyond the boundaries or to accept the boundaries and sort of go around them. So to see failure as a beautiful part of the creative process is my happiest discovery over the past 20 years as a working artist.
Well, that is a lovely way to put it.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Lauren Groff, who is the Zale Kimmerling Writer in Residence at Newcomb College Institute in March. She will present a public reading Monday, March 16th at 7 in the Kendall Cram Room at the Lavenbernick Center at Tulane University. Don't miss it. Lauren, thank you so much.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Amy Bonifons is one of the most interesting writers I know. She conjures a particular kind of seductive weirdness that makes you want to read whatever she writes, whether it's the story of a woman becoming a horse in her story collection, The Wrong Heaven, or the tale of a woman in love with a man caught between life and death in her new book, The Regrets. Readers are captivated. Amy Bonifons has an MFA from NYU and is currently pursuing her PhD in creative writing at the University of Georgia. Amy Bonifons, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us the premise behind this book, The Regrets.
So the premise of The Regret is that when we die, we're taken by a sexy angel of death to a kind of bureaucratic Kafka-esque office where we're processed for the afterlife and then transition into the afterlife. And our main character, Thomas, dies and reaches that sort of way station and is told that his death is incomplete and he can't be processed for the afterlife and he's being sent back to Earth as a result to live for a few months in a kind of limbo while they ready themselves to accept him. And during that state, he's given a list of rules to follow that are very stringent, one being don't get involved with any living humans. And of course, that's a rule that he breaks. He ends up having an affair with a living woman named Rachel, and that's when things get complicated.
So in other words, don't do anything that would cause regrets, and you rush right out. Now, Rachel, who is certainly one of the most appealing librarians in fiction, he catches her eye immediately. It's like they're meant to cross each other's line of sight.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you'd read a little bit about her life in the library, which is such an appealing place, as always.
Sure. I work at a library. Not a fancy university library, and not one of the large, venerable city libraries with marble steps or grand lobbies or statues of lions guarding the door. My library is a squat, shabby brick building on a side street in a quiet outer borough neighborhood. Our main patrons are elderly people who use the elderly computers to check their elderly AOL accounts, or who stop by to read the newspaper in Polish and then shuffle out with disgruntled looks on their faces, taking zero books. There are some toddlers during the day whose parents and nannies leave piles of sticky picture books on the reading together carpet for us to clean up. And every day at around 3, school children storm in and occupy the place for a few hours, loitering loudly, sitting at the large splintery wood tables to do homework, which really means finding excuses to giggle and poke each other with fingers and pencils under their shirts, testing their newly pubescent bodies as if for doneness. Technically, I am the reference librarian, but very few of our patrons require me for reference. I spend a lot of time straightening up things and alphabetizing. I love alphabetizing. I live for the lulls when I can travel slowly around the shelves, straightening spines, reordering titles. There's something so soothing in this, some inner rocking that happens when I move through the book, not conscious of their content, but just of their physicality, their presence in the world as containers of words organized into patterns. I touch them one by one, and one by one, they are there. Only two other people work at the library, Joanne and Tanya. Neither of them seems to care much about books. Joanne mostly creates these terrible after-school events where she dresses up like Miss Frizzle from the Magic School Bus and manipulates kids into making things out of construction paper. If you're a crazy person in New York, there are many ways to shape your craziness so that its contours fit smoothly into the vessel of other people's expectations. For example, most kids believe Joanne is the literal Miss Frizzle from the Magic School Bus just because she has red hair and wears elaborate earrings. They believe that if they make construction paper bookmarks according to her instructions, might take them to outer space or inside the human body. They always leave with this half-disappointed, half-relieved air that says, the world may be less magical than I thought.
And magic is something you love and write about so beautifully. So talk a little bit about that role of magic and that appeal and that moment when you sit down to make magic and be a magician.
I think there is magic in the real world and that there's less of a distinction than we commonly think, which isn't to say that I think that actually people can turn into horses or make love with ghosts in the way I describe in my book. But I think there's a blurring of that line that I'm interested in and that I think we're encouraged to not pay attention to, or we're encouraged to draw a really hard line between reality and something else in our culture, and we define reality really narrowly. So that's one reason that I kind of push those boundaries in my fiction, is I think there's some things that it's hard to describe otherwise. And also, I think there's a magic quality to some of the things the characters experience in this book that we all experience, like sex and love and grief and the haunting of grief. And so to use a magical conceit to explore them is just a kind of faithfulness to the emotional reality that the characters are living within.
Well, you make Rachel so well-rounded and so open to the possibilities of magic and other things, you know. So she's a librarian and she tells people, I needed to touch books. And, you know, she says, I touched the books and one by one they're there. And yet she is able to fall in love with a ghost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rachel's a character who really lives in her head and in her imagination. And precisely because of that, it's like she needs to anchor herself in the physical world through her job. And in her love life, she has trouble sort of distinguishing between, I guess, what we call fantasy or projection and reality. She refers to it as the daydream. She says she falls in love with a daydream, and then the daydream will show up and embodied as a man. And eventually, the relationship will outlive the daydream, and that's why she has trouble staying in a relationship.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Amy Bonifons, whose new novel is The Regrets. You seem to me to be so fascinated by the process of metamorphosis, just as the woman in Horse, so it is with Thomas, who's moving on to this other state, to the afterlife. And you don't shy away from imagining what that looks like. It is so interesting to have to think about the literal details.
Yeah, I think that base of liminality, you know, when you're between two things, when you're between worlds or between life and death or between being a good one, being an animal, like that space is really fascinating to me as a fiction writer. I as opposed to, you know, like a poet or a philosopher, I have to make it really concrete for readers and give some details that people can hold on to. And that's really the fun part for me.
Was this longer form fun for you too, after those short stories?
Oh, it was everything. You know, at times it was really fun. At times it was incredibly frustrating and difficult. I worked on this book for 8 years. And so, you know, there were a lot of false starts, a lot of revisions, a lot of pages that didn't make it into the final book. And of course, like a lot of wondering whether it was worth it, whether I'd ever finish it, whether anyone would ever see it. So yeah, all of that. But it was also quite fun to write, especially the scenes that happened between the lovers were really fun to write.
And fun to read.
Good, I'm glad.
Very much so, very much so. We've been talking with Amy Bonifons, whose new novel, her first, is The Regrets. You can meet her Sunday, March 1st at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
is What's on Tap in the Literary Life this week here in New Orleans. Amy Bonifance reads from and signs The Regrets, Sunday, March 1st at 2 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. The New Orleans Public Library is sponsoring a Black History Month student poster design contest. All entries will be judged on creativity, artistic merit, and best representation of the 2020 Black History Month theme, African Americans and the Vote. Winning posters will be displayed at all 15 library locations, and copies will be given to winners and their schools. The deadline is Saturday, February 29th at 5 to enter or pick up a form at any library. The New Orleans Public Library is also hosting an adult writing contest for Black History Month, open to any and all writers in Orleans Parish. Poetry, stories, and essays on the theme of roots are welcome. Deadline, February 28th. Tulane University Special Collections has a new exhibit, Where We Stand, Zines from New Orleans, on display now until April 3rd at Tulane University Special Collections, second floor gallery, 6801 Ferret Street, Joseph Merrick Jones Hall, on Tulane's Uptown campus. Hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, free admission. March begins festival season in the literary life here with four on the way this month alone. First up, the 17th Annual Jambalaya Writers Conference takes place Saturday, March 14th at the Terrebonne Parish Library. That's at 151 Library Drive in Ahoma. Headliners this year include Lisa Gardner, Carolyn Kapnis, romance writers Carolyn Brown and Laura Drake, novelists Samantha Downing and Maurice Carlos Ruffin, children's author Marty Dumas, and urban fantasy author Diana Rowland, many more. The New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University takes place March 19th through 21st. Headliners, you'll need a ticket for these events, include John Grisham, Malcolm Gladwell, Michael Lewis, and Sean Tuohy in conversation. Other writers include Eric Larson, Nicholas Lemon, Nancy Lemon, David Brooks, Samantha Power, Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough, Dave Eggers, Eddie Claude Jr., Annette Gordon-Reed, Valerie Jarrett, Kiese Lehman, James Carville and Mary Madeline, and Susan Rice. Saturday is Family Day, which will feature family-friendly activities, a full roster of children's book authors, and book giveaways. Check out bookfest.tulane.edu for the schedule coming up in early March. March 25th through 29th brings the 34th annual Tennessee Williams in New Orleans Literary Festival. The weekend event includes theatrical productions, walking tours, masterclasses, food events, musical performances, and literary discussion by headliners Kathleen Turner, novelist Colm Tobin, NPR's Maureen Corrigan, Jamie Attenberg, Andre Kudrescu, Beth Ann Fenley, Jewel Gomez, Saeed Jones, Sister Helen Prejean, Lee Camacho Rourkes, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, John Warner Smith, Katie Simpson Smith, and Edmund White. Visit TennesseeWilliams.net for schedule and tickets. Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival takes place March 27th through 29th, celebrating its 17th year. Featured writers this year include Jewel Gomez, Irina Klepfisch, Trevor Healy, Alex Myers, Andrew Holleran, Felice Picano, Colm Tobin, Edmund White, and many others. Visit sasfest.org for more details. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. Thank you.